This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Are you the type of person who likes to browse the internet in incognito mode? Yeah. Do you take full advantage of those privacy settings in your web browser? Well, no matter how careful you think you're being with your data on the internet, there is one group that knows exactly what you've been up to online, and that is your service provider. This week, President Trump signed a law overturning an Obama-era regulation that would have made it harder for providers like AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile to keep track of what you do online and sell it to third-party groups like credit card companies. The regulation was passed last fall by a then-Democratic majority on the Federal Communications Commission, but it hadn't gone into effect yet. Here to tell us more about this latest development and other selected short subjects in science is Maggie Girthbaker, senior science reporter with 538.com. She joins us from Minnesota Public NPR. NPR in Minneapolis. Welcome back, Maggie.
Hi, how are you?
Nice to talk to you. Let's get right to it. So are internet service providers, are they taking our data and doing something with it?
Yeah, so you know how Google and Facebook have these targeted ads that are based on what you've been searching for or liking on their sites? These rules were designed to prevent your internet service provider from basically joining in that game on a broader scale. So instead of just a website, it would cover everything that you do online. You know, these rules would have banned the internet service providers from sharing or selling information about your health, finances, all the websites you visit, even the embarrassing ones, without explicitly getting your okay first. And that information is valuable to them because they can sell it or they can use it to create profiles of their customer base that they can sell. All Tech Considered had a really great interview with the CEO of the Future of Privacy Forum talking about these third-party advertising exchanges where people can go in and just purchase info about individuals or groups that they want to sell ads to. And some companies like Comcast have promised that they're not going to sell your individual data, but that's just a promise. It's completely non-binding.
Mm. So what was Congress's justification then for overturning a rule that would have protected internet user privacy?
Basically, for Congress, this was about the rule being unfair because it was going to apply to internet service providers, but Google and Facebook could still do the same thing. They weren't going to be bound by the requirements. So you had people like Congressman Jeff Flake of Arizona framing this as protecting consumers from confusing government regulatory overreach. Of course, you know, Google and Facebook are both a lot less all-encompassing and they're easier to leave. A third of all Americans don't really have any choice in who their ISP is at all.
Hmm. So when they sell their data, if and when they do that, are they going to give out information about us personally, or is it basically where we live and things like that without knowing exactly whom we are?
Now it could be either.
Wow. Really?
Yep. So I hope you know what
there.
You've been looking at.
So, all right, let's talk about it. So we're not going to get help from the government anytime soon. Is there any way that we can hide our data from our service providers?
Yeah, there are a few things that I found that people were recommending. And some of this starts with just really basic stuff like keeping an eye out for the emails and the letters that you get from your internet service provider, because sometimes some of those are actually opt-out requests, like the chance that you're getting to say, please don't do this, actually. And there's also little lowercase i's on banner ads, and that's an opt-out option too. So if you see those, that means somebody's collecting data about you and using it to make an ad to target you, and that's your opt-out option. You can also use encrypted search engines like DuckDuckGo, and because your ISP isn't the only one gathering information about you. You know, this is stuff that Google does. This is stuff that Facebook does. This is stuff that lots of websites do. And finally, there's the virtual private network, which can really mask your location and encrypt what you do online. And it's good for both privacy and for protecting you from hackers when you do things like use a public Wi-Fi network. There are a couple ways you can do this. The easy way is by hiring a VPN provider for about $75 a year. And the hard way is setting up your own, which will require you to have a computer at home that's always on. And either way, you got to remember to turn your VPN on every single time you join a new network.
And on your same thing with your iPhone or your cell phone, right?
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
And now I've been looking at some VPNs, and on our website we have some links on how to do that at sciencefriday.com/VPN. It will turn the stuff on automatically, right? You can have a little switch on your cell phone that will turn the VPN on.
I've seen some of them that do that, and then I've seen others where you have to remember to turn it on each time, and it just kind of depends on what program you're using and what whether you're using it on your computer or your phone.
Yes, and there is a little bit of trade-off possibly with speed and bandwidth when you do that.
Yep.
And use the VPN. So there is there's something, you know, so there's always a trade-off. Let's move on to something else that I want to talk about. Our next story is about the Tasmanian tiger might be extinct, but then again, it might not be. Tell us about that.
So the Tasmanian tiger looks like a dog, but it's got a pouch like a kangaroo. It's a marsupial. And the last one died in a zoo in 1936, supposedly.
You say supposedly.
Well, there have been, you know, these sightings over the course of decades. And some of the sightings, particularly recent ones, have actually been credible enough that it's starting to get the attention of scientists. And so this team from Australia's James Cook University is setting up this network of camera traps across Tasmania in all of these places where some of these credible, credible sightings have happened, trying to see if maybe we can catch a glimpse of this animal that we thought was dead.
Yeah, it seems pretty low tech, right?
Not
a big budget involved.
Well, I don't know what the budget is for this project, but, you know, it is cameras. It's camera traps. It's not anything really crazily high tech, but it's very scientific in that, you know, it's the kind of thing where you're doing this really methodical survey of all of these sites via the 50 camera traps you bring with you, right? So it's not just like standing out trying to be that person who gets the picture of Bigfoot. It's moving, you know, one segment of land at a time and working your way across the area.
Collecting data can be pretty boring sometimes.
It can.
But necessary.
But wouldn't it be amazing to find a Tasmanian tiger?
I'd love to see that. Thank you. Thank you, Maggie. Nice to have you back. Maggie Kurth-Baker is a senior science reporter with 538. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Last month, the Department of Transportation released new figures showing that nearly all Americans, 97% of us, could be exposed to a background hum of airplane and highway noise. That's actually right outside my office. That sound is coming from, clocking in at about 35 to 50 decibels. And that's about the loudness of a humming refrigerator. And while that may not seem loud, even that soft hum can be enough to disturb your sleep, according to the World Health Organization. Among other health effects, we'll talk about in a moment, but yes, there is a silver lining too. Here to tell us the good and the bad is Susie Nielsen. She's a journalist who writes about science and society, and her articles on noise, called Noise is a Drug and New York is Full of Addicts, appears in the latest issue of Nautilus Magazine. Welcome to Science Friday, Susie.
Hello, Ira. Great to be here.
Let's go in reverse. We usually do the good. Let's do the bad first. Let's start with the bad. Living around a lot of noise sounds like a bad thing.
Yeah, and you know, it's true that for the most part, living around a lot of noise can be really detrimental. So for one, I mean, obviously there's hearing loss, which can occur at regular exposure to really high levels of noise. So if you work around subways or around airplanes, but even, you know, if you're living in New York and regularly exposed to traffic, which can get really high to like 85 decibels. And then there are the secondary exposure effects to noise levels, which, so noise is a stressor on the body. So it can produce cortisol, which is the stress hormone, and prolonged cortisol flooding can lead to a lot of negative health effects, including, I mean, if you're a finance bro, then you'll have these effects too.
Cortisol is not a good thing to have flowing through your veins.
Yeah, exactly. And if you're in New York, a place like New York or any place with a lot of noise, those effects compound. And some of the effects that people have documented, particularly with high noise levels, include there are increased rates of heart attacks for people. You can also experience depression and respiratory illnesses. So it's really overall not a great thing to be living around a lot of noise.
All right. Now I understand, though, there is a good thing. What's the good part about the noise?
Yeah, so this is actually really interesting for me to research. So when I moved to New York, I was so struck by the high levels of noise. And I lived in the East Village, and construction would start at 6 a.m. and continue into the evening. And at midnight, there were all these garbage trucks. And I thought, how am I going to live with all these noises all the time? But as I got habituated to the noise, I found myself kind of missing it when I left. And I found that I was kind of looking at all of these other people that moved to New York and realizing that there's this common thread of the way people talk about New York noise that's the sort of love-hate relationship. Yeah. So Joan Didion, the writer, in her essay Goodbye to All That, writes about all the different kinds of noise she's exposed to on a daily basis, the visual noise, the sensory noise, the smell, the smells, and how it sort of contributes to her creativity. And so I started wondering, is there a relationship between the way that we think and the noise that we're exposed to? And I found this study by Dr. Ravi Mehta, who's a neuroscientist, who found out that there's actually this kind of Goldilocks relationship between noise and human creativity. So at a certain level of noise, people are actually more creative and they think more freely because the noise allows them a little bit of distance between the workings of their mind and the sort of external world.
Yeah, it's sort of a little stimulant. But I guess if you go too far, it's going to get in the way.
Yeah, exactly.
Of your creativity.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because people's levels are different. So I have ADD, and so for me, a higher level of noise is actually good because my internal level of noise is a little lower because I have a little less dopamine flooding through my neurotransmitters. So I do best at a level of, like, 80, which is why I think I'm good in New York.
Okay. So everybody who has ADD, come on down to New York.
Yeah, come to New York. That's why there are so many of us here.
He'll flourish like Susie Nielsen, a journalist, did, based in the Pacific Northwest. She writes about this in a magazine, Nautilus. We're going to take a break, and Michael Mann is going to be here to talk with us about his experience on the latest House Science Committee hearing on climate change. You can also get in on our conversation. 844-724-8255 is the number. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. After the election, there was a lot of talking about political bubbles, that the information we read and how we access is drawing us into tighter circles around party lines. Conservatives reading books and blogs that liberals may not even have heard of. It goes both ways. This makes sense for news or political books, but does it hold up when it comes to science? A group of researchers looked at just that. They tracked what science books conservatives and liberals were buying. The study was published this week in the journal Nature Human Behavior. Michael Macy is an author on that study. He's also professor of sociology and director of the Social Dynamics Lab at Cornell University in Ithaca. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. Great to be here.
Nice to have you. You looked at co-purchases of books people bought online. Tell us what you did in your study, what you found.
Yes, we looked at Amazon and Barnes & Noble book recommendations, where if you go on Amazon and you buy a book, there'll be a little section underneath where Amazon says, customers who bought this book also bought. And that's based on co-purchase patterns. So we used those data that are available on the Amazon website through their API, and we looked at hand-coded liberal and conservative books, and then we looked to see when people bought one of those liberal or conservative books, what other books did they buy? In particular, what other science books did they buy?
And what did you find? You find there was a common thread?
The common thread is that liberals and conservatives are both interested in science. In fact, they're more likely to buy books on science than they are books on, let's say, performing arts or sports, literature, religion. They're more likely to buy books on science. So they share an interest in science, at least science in general. But that's about as far as it goes. They don't buy the same books, and they don't buy books on the same topics.
So what kind of topics do liberals or conservatives buy?
Well, we found that conservatives are more likely to buy books in applied science, that is, sciences that are motivated mainly by problem solving, things like medicine and law, whereas liberals were more likely to buy books on basic science, that is, science that's motivated by empirical puzzles or by theoretical curiosity.
Is there what type of science you mentioned that they liked? Is there where does the twain meet? Is there one science they both like?
Yes, it turns out that we can all agree on dinosaurs.
Why am I not surprised?
Paleontology is one of the areas that liberals and conservatives do tend to buy the same books. This also in oceanography, plant science, veterinary medicine, zoology. Those are topics where liberals and conservatives can agree.
So what you're finding is basically what we hear in on blogs and whatever, that the bubble exists in the book buying business too.
Yes, that's right. And in fact, we also found another difference between liberals and conservatives. Conservatives had a tendency to purchase books in science that were mostly purchased by other conservatives, and were books that had a somewhat more political slant, whereas liberals were more likely to buy books that would be purchased by just a general audience for science, including people who don't buy any political books.
And does it tell you anything about how each of these groups view science in general?
Well, we can speculate from that pattern that conservatives are somewhat more interested in science that confirms political opinions and political beliefs, whereas liberals were somewhat more likely to see science just for science's sake. For sure, they read science books that are consistent with a liberal viewpoint and not books that have a conservative viewpoint, but they also are more interested in books that just would be interesting to anyone on that topic.
Fascinating. I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today, Dr. Macy.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Ira.
Michael Macy is Goldwyn Smith, a professor of arts and sciences and sociology and director of the Social Dynamics Lab at Cornell University in Ithaca. Climate change can be one of those issues that draws the deepest divide between liberals and conservatives, and the place where this can be most apparent is in Congress. Last month, the House Science Committee held a hearing on climate change and the scientific method. Lamar Smith, chairman of the committee, Republican chairman, opened the hearing by saying that, quote, "much of climate science today seems to be based more on exaggerations, personal agendas, and questionable predictions than on the scientific methods," unquote. The stated goal of the hearing was to evaluate the science of climate change, but critics say it was just meant to attack the science. One of the expert witnesses on that panel was climate scientist Michael Mann. So he's here to talk about the role of scientists in the contentious congressional hearing process. Dr. Mann joins us to give us views. He's the distinguished professor of atmospheric science and director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State, also author of The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. We did reach out to Representative Smith's office for a comment, but we have not yet received a response. Welcome to Science Friday, Michael.
Thanks, Ira. Always good to be with you.
How would you describe the hearing?
Well, I think you summarized it quite well. It was clearly intended by Congressman Lamar Smith, who is a climate change denier. He does not accept overwhelming scientific consensus on human-caused climate change. He has spent much of his time as the chair of the House Science Committee going on the attack against climate scientists, issuing subpoenas to demand their emails, trying to cut funding for climate science at government funding agencies. So he sort of has taken on an adversarial position when it comes to the science of climate change. And the hearing was, I think, intended to try to convey his doubts and his critiques of the science. And there were three witnesses that actually are sort of in the fringe of scientists who do not accept the science of climate change or the reality of the impacts of climate change. And I was the sole sort of representative of the scientific consensus that climate change is indeed real and human-caused.
You knew what the committee was about and what you, the lion's den you were going into. Why even go into something like this?
It's a fair question. You know, when do we engage and when do we decide to not, you know, legitimize what appears to be a forum for just fomenting doubt and confusion in the public mindset? And I'll tell you, my good friend Bill Nye, the science guy, has really demonstrated, I think, that you do sometimes have to take the science straight to the critics. You really do have to take on science denial, because if it goes unopposed, then some of it becomes sort of accepted. The doubts, the confusion becomes part of the discourse, and it clouds the public understanding of science. And so we do need to do our best to inject science into those fora, and that's what I saw my role as being, to really communicate why it is that there is such a widespread consensus about human-caused climate change, why it is that scientists are convinced by the evidence, by multiple independent lines of evidence, that human-caused climate change is real and it represents a risk. It presents a threat that we need to do something about.
Do you think there's anybody in that room whose mind you can change about this?
Well, you know, there's the famous adage, Upton Sinclair, it's very difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on not understanding it. And I think that probably applies writ large to much of Congress. But I saw as the relevant audience here, onlookers, the public, staffers, other policymakers who may be genuinely confused. Even though there is overwhelming scientific consensus, they may have bought into the myth that there is a scientific debate about the reality of climate change. And so, yes, there are partisans whose minds are made up. They don't see this through the lens of science anymore, but through the lens of ideology, and it's going to be difficult to reach them. But there's this broad sort of confused middle, as I describe it, who thinks there's a debate because of the fractious public discourse over this issue. And if they can be led to understand that there is not a debate, then they may indeed be able to make quite a bit of progress in their, not only their acceptance of the science, but their interest in trying to do something about it.
Do you take issue with scientists who say, and some of them even are pushing back on the March on Science that's coming up in a couple of weeks, that scientists should not get involved in politics?
Well, you know, I used to be one of those scientists, frankly, and back in the late 1990s, my co-authors and I published the hockey stick curve, and it became an icon in the climate change debate, and I quickly found myself at the center of attacks by climate change critics looking to discredit the hockey stick curve as a way of, you know, supposedly discrediting the case for concern over climate change. Through those experiences and through my efforts to try to push back against the misinformation and disinformation and to try to inform the discourse over climate change, I've become convinced that we play a critical role, that scientists' voices need to be heard. I made this case in an op-ed a few years ago in the New York Times entitled, "If You See Something, Say Something," that draws upon, of course, the motto of our Department of Homeland Security. Look, the taxpayers are paying us to study this problem. It would be a dereliction of a responsibility if we didn't do our best to at least inform the public and political discourse over this issue. There's a legitimate debate to be had about what we do about this problem. There isn't a legitimate debate to be had anymore about whether the problem exists.
Mm-hmm. I noticed I got a note as a journalist. I got a note from Senator Bill Nelson of Florida, Democrat from Florida, on the Senate Committee on Science, Commerce, and Transportation, that he is holding a hearing about extreme weather in West Palm Beach, in Florida, yeah, on Monday. They're discussing resilience and reinsurance. That seems like it's something that's out of the ordinary, like, you know, taking it down to the grassroots level.
You know, absolutely. And, you know, in Miami Beach, Florida, look, they don't have time to debate the science of climate change. They're dealing with the impacts right now. They are on the front lines of the impacts of climate change in the form of sea level rise, combining with potentially more dangerous storms that threatens our coastlines. Or, you know, you talk to farmers in Oklahoma and Texas who lost 25% of their cattle in the unprecedented 2011 heat wave and drought. You talk to Californians who had been dealing with an unprecedented drought, a devastating drought, only now to be dealing with the opposite extreme, flooding. And there is an emerging scientific literature demonstrating that climate change is impacting many of these extreme weather events. So, look, you know, there is a legitimate debate, as I said, to be had mm-hmm. about the policies, but there are conservatives who are coming on board. Increasingly, you see some Republicans coming out and saying, look, let's get on the right side of the science. We can debate what to do about it, but our people are dealing with these impacts as well, and we need to act.
And in fact, I've seen some conservatives saying, you know, now that President Trump has said that he may be pulling out or does not believe in the Paris Accords, that China now is going to be seen as the biggest country in the world that is going to embrace, you know, doing things about carbon emissions, and the U.S. is going to look second. And they were actually unhappy with that position.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is unilateral economic disarmament. The greatest economic revolution of this century is the clean energy revolution, and China recognizes that, and they're leading the world. They're selling their solar panels to the rest of the world, profiting from that, actually flooding the market and bringing down the cost of solar energy. The rest of the world recognizes that the future of our global economy is in renewable energy, and the question we have to ask is whether we get on board or we get left behind.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Michael Mann. Some scientists who are skeptical of the climate change consensus, they want to put together what they're calling red teams that would probe these findings and be funded by Congress. Do you think this could happen?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that Lamar Smith has said publicly, the chair of the House Science Committee we were talking about, is he would like to get rid of peer review at the National Science Foundation and replace that with congressional oversight. That is, of course, very frightening to the world scientists who understand that peer review is sort of the gold standard. It's what keeps, you know, science on this path towards understanding and truth. It's what, you know, Carl Sagan referred to as the self-correcting machinery of science. And now you have political partisans like Lamar Smith who want to basically gut that, interfere with this process that has served us so well over the centuries with the technology and science that we now rely upon, to threaten that by trying to insert political ideology into decisions about what gets funded. And we know what those decisions will be. If Lamar Smith were to have his way, we would not see funding for climate change research. We would not see funding for studies even of resilience, of how we deal with the impacts of climate change, which people in red states and blue states alike are now dealing with. And so it's deeply disturbing, this idea of red teams. What that really means is they don't like the message that they're hearing, the overwhelming message of the world scientists, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, all the national academies of all the industrial nations, all the scientific societies in the U.S. that have weighed in on the matter, all on record as being convinced by the many lines of evidence that human-caused climate change is real, and it's a threat. And they don't like the message that they're mm-hmm. hearing, and so they want to somehow create an alternative universe that tells them what they want to hear rather than what's true.
Talking about the upcoming science march, do you think this will have any lasting effect, or is it a one-shot protest?
I hope it does have a lasting effect, and I will be there. I will be speaking at the rally. I'll be marching with my good friend Bill Nye, and I'm very excited that so many scientific societies and organizations have come on board endorsing the march. AAAS, the American Geophysical Union, the American Physical Society, pretty conservative scientific society, because they recognize collectively that science right now is under threat, a threat unlike anything we've ever seen before in this country. And scientists, you know, I can tell you, I am one, and many of my friends are fellow scientists. We sort of prefer to be left alone in our labs or out in the field doing what we love doing, studying nature, understanding, trying to gain an understanding of the way things furthering our understanding of the natural world. The last thing scientists want to be doing is getting political and being out in the streets marching. But essentially, we've been forced into that by this unprecedented attack on science that we're seeing.
Of course, if you had more scientists in Congress, you might have a little more support. And that's a topic for another show. Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science and Director of the Earth Systems Science Center at Penn State, author of The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. Thank you for taking time to be with us
today. Thanks so much,
Ira. You're welcome. We're going to take a break, but coming up, it takes a wheel that's out of this world to keep a Mars rover on the move. But what happens when they start to break prematurely? Yeah, you know, those rovers are going over rough terrain. They have really thin metal wheels that we'll talk about research to design new wheels for the next rovers. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Visit NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California, and you expect to find scientists working to send robots to distant planets, moons, and Mars. What you might not expect to find is robotic torture, dismemberment, or robot sadism. Science Friday's Christy Taylor paid a visit and met engineers working hard on the Mars 2020 rover mission. And she reports back on one component, very vital component, the wheels that keep it all rolling.
This story actually starts with Curiosity, the six-wheeled rover crawling across the red planet like a slow-moving dune buggy. It's October 2013. It's been exploring for 411 sols, or Martian days. That's about 14 months. And it's rolling slowly towards the foothills of Mount Sharp, where the sediments may reveal 2 billion years worth of Martian history. And then a photo shows something foreboding, a hole in the left front wheel. By November, more holes appeared, and they got bigger, inches across in places. So NASA called in the engineering equivalent of the cavalry, a rapid response team called a Tiger Team. It was a Tiger Team that helped see the Apollo 13 lander safely back to Earth in 1970. In 2013, this Tiger Team's job was to find out why the wheels were breaking, and whether these holes would stop Curiosity's mission in its tracks. Patrick DeGross was one of the Tigers.
It's my job to design, qualify, and deliver the suspension, the wheels, the differential, everything that makes the rover rove around Mars.
DeGross's mission? Test copies of Curiosity's wheels here on Earth on simulated Mars terrain to see how long they'd last, and to see whether Curiosity could finish its 20-kilometer trek to its science targets. Now, you might think it doesn't take much engineering to build a wheel. We solved this thousands of years ago, right? But for a planet where the nighttime temperature dips below negative 275 degrees Fahrenheit, where you can't send a mechanic at the slightest glitch, it takes a wheel unlike anything found on Earth.
Using things like rubber where there's glass transition temperatures to contend with isn't an option for us.
What is a glass transition temperature?
So you ever take like a bouncy ball or see an experiment with a bouncy ball that goes into liquid nitrogen, and then you throw it on the ground and it no longer bounces, it shatters into a million pieces. That's because it has crossed its glass transition temperature.
That's what would happen to rubber tires on Mars. So Mars rovers need something different, some other material. But the wheels need to be as light as possible also, just like everything else we shoot into space. So we build them from aluminum and super thin, just 4 times as thick as a Coke can. Another reason these wheels are different? They also double as landing gear for the sky crane-assisted descent to Martian soil. Once in their life, these wheels have to absorb 17,000 pounds of impact. They do it with the right aluminum alloy, supportive spokes, and a few other engineering tricks. Which brings us back to that first big hole in Curiosity's wheel. How did it get there if this thing's made of such strong metal? Patrick takes me to a nondescript shed that's actually a graveyard or maybe catacombs for rover wheels, shelves full of them, all looking like they've been torn apart by a giant can opener or poked repeatedly with a knife.
This wheel that's up on the top in the center here, this one saw a single wheel test track for most of its life, and it's essentially punctured to death.
Some of the test wheels Patrick shows me are torn nearly down the middle, ripped like a piece of tissue paper, right where the spokes meet the wheel. This is from metal fatigue, as the wheel flexed in tiny repetitions over long periods of time. Other wheels were repeatedly punctured by rocks and are now peppered with holes. These wheels are all examples of what could happen to Curiosity on different kinds of Martian terrain after months and kilometers of different tests. And where Patrick takes me next is ground zero for testing those rover wheels here on Earth. A sandbox for robots with a lot of rocks thrown in for fun.
So we're standing out here on the observation deck of JPL's Mars Yard.
It's like a big, dusty football field with a few different slopes, flat, smooth flagstones like you might see in landscaping, sharp rocks, big rocks, sand, and dust. My shoes and microphone cords will come home covered in a fine layer of silt. And then, up the hill, there's another test space, a round ring like a kid's pony ride, that a set of three wheels traverse over and over, circles upon circles, at less than a third of a mile per hour. That awful sound is the wheels, grinding slowly over a smorgasbord of rocks, round and round and round for up to 60 kilometers. This torture track is the place where all those punctured rolling gladiators we saw earlier met their maker, testing whether the wheels can go the distance they would need to on Mars. Most of them couldn't. The good news is that even an awful, chewed-up-looking wheel can still rove across Mars pretty well. Take Curiosity. Just last month, it snapped two raised treads on one wheel. Looks pretty gnarly, but it's still rolling. It just has to be more selective about where it roves to get the most science done before the damage piles up. With 15 kilometers down, it should easily finish out the mission goal of 20. Meanwhile, Patrick has his eye on the next Mars mission, Mars 2020, already in development. He wants to give that rover a wheel that can drive over anything. Back down in the Mars yard, a pared-down version of a rover demonstrates how the Mars 2020's wheels might behave. Does the rover slip going uphill or bog down in sand or stumble on a sharp piece of rock? And physics equations? They can't tell you any of that. This test track, the Mars yard, is the only way to really understand this vehicle's many tiny interactions with the physics of Mars.
You don't sit down at your computer and draw up the complexity of sand grains and rocks and what all those friction coefficients are and how they tumble over each other when a wheel hits them. We're just not at that stage now.
That's Chris Salvo, another engineer.
I'm the manager for the part of the project that delivers the stuff that looks like a rover.
The Mars yard is also a place to test weird, new phenomena we've never before seen on Earth. Like what they're building right now. It's a dune field, but a type of sand dunes you'd never find on Earth today, because we just don't have the right wind and atmospheric conditions to drift sand around like that. These small, repeating sand dunes, they're about a meter apart, and known as ripples. They've been causing Curiosity to stall. Patrick DeGrosse.
It seems to be the thing that everyone on 2020's surface planning team is a bit scared of.
Building and testing ripples here on Earth will bring us that much closer to a Mars 2020 wheel that can take anything the red planet throws at it. Here's what else Patrick and his team have figured out for 2020. Rover wheels need a thicker skin, a whopping 60 thousandths of an inch instead of 30. As thick as a dime, even if that means more weight. And they've also changed the layout of the spokes inside the wheels, reducing some of the forces that cause the wheels to fatigue down the middle. The treads are bigger, and they're using more modern forging techniques to shape the aluminum, plus a few other tweaks that, I'll be honest, are a bit too nerdy for radio. And all those tweaks will be tested more before liftoff and as the whole rover comes together. Chris Salvo.
I'm personally looking forward to the centrifuge test. If you've seen any of those commercials where they put a pickup truck on a centrifuge and spin it around, that's the test rig. So I'm looking forward to going out there and making our rover experience 18 Gs.
Do you sleep at night?
No, not until it's done.
After all the tests are done, Patrick, Chris, and the other engineers will have to say goodbye to the rover that's still, really, just a twinkle in their eyes.
We personify them, we have emotion about them, and you know we want to see them succeed. When this rover gets dropped onto the surface of Mars, there's definitely a bit of a heartache, a little loneliness that sets in because you won't be able to see it again.
By that point, the Mars 2020 rover will have a name, hopefully one as auspicious as Curiosity, Spirit, or Opportunity, and it'll be hard at work, crawling across Mars, looking for signs of past microscopic life. And maybe, just maybe, sending us postcards that reveal the first hints of life on another world. With such a grand vision, it's only fitting that we'd have to reinvent the wheel to get there. For Science Friday, I'm Christy Taylor.
And if you want to look at the Mars yard, we have photos and more of that lovely grinding rover noise up on our website at sciencefriday.com/rover. Shout out to our web producer, Lauren Young, for that great rover wheel gallery that is up there. Plus, you can try to make your own rover wheels. Sochi Garcia from our education team has a great activity you can try for reinventing wheels. And you can do that at Science Friday, all of that, sciencefriday.com/wheels. And now, yes, ever wonder if that sneezing person next to you on the bus is going to get you sick, or maybe you stand back as soon as you flush that toilet to avoid the flying bacteria. I'm with you on this one. My next guest can tell you that's probably a good idea. She peers deep into the spatter of tiny droplets to model how diseases spread. That sneeze? Turns out it goes higher in the air than we thought, and you might not want to know about all those drops from the toilet. Lydia Buriba is an assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering and mechanical engineering at MIT in Cambridge. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
What do you know about sneezes that the rest of us don't?
Well, I guess I looked at many more with the type of lighting and imagery that most people don't use.
And what did you see? I noticed that in the sneezes that we saw in our video, that they travel in a pattern that we really don't expect them to.
Exactly. So when I started looking at this phenomena, what I discovered that I guess other people didn't see before is that a cloud was really coming out during sneezes and coughs, so these violent expirations, and that it was not just isolated drops that were emitted, which was our prior physical picture of the event. So that turbulent cloud is carrying these drops and has very high momentum, so basically can travel quite fast, and is in some sense entrapping these drops and carrying them away in the room, further away from the sneezer horizontally, but also allowing them to travel upward in a room.
They go up because they're warmer than the air, so they rise, and you point out in the video that that's got to be the worst thing that can happen for us, the sneeze droplets, because a lot of the air conditioning intake vents are in the ceiling where the sneeze is going right up there.
That's right. So, in fact, the turbulent cloud is a multi-phase cloud. So there's a gaseous phase and the droplets, and then eventually these drops are also evaporating into droplet nuclei, which contain basically dried up pathogens. But the cloud itself, this air, is hot and moist, as you mentioned, and that's what makes it eventually turn up when that momentum forward, that velocity, starts reducing. And indeed, it is the worst-case scenario in modern buildings where most of the suction and ventilation is upward.
Wow, so we're just recirculating the sneeze.
That's right. Basically, we're dispersing that, and most ventilation systems indoors do not have filters between rooms. So whatever is remaining in that cloud that reaches the ceiling can be redistributed.
I think everybody in our audience is looking at the ceiling. But it gets worse than this, because you've also turned your camera onto flushing toilets. Let me ask you about that after I tell everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Do I want to know what organisms those can spread and how they're being spread?
That's right. So actually, I want to reassure also the audience, sneezes are not always, they could be a reaction of an allergic, stimulus and all of that. So the worst case scenarios we're talking about are really in cases of hospitals and in times of outbreaks or epidemics, pandemics. And that's when we really need to know what are the risks of transmission and basically motion of these pathogens from room to room. And similarly, for the high-pressure toilet flushes, initially when I started looking at that problem, it was also in the context of C. difficile, so Clostridium difficile propagation and transmission in hospital settings, where, in fact, the design of the facilities have included a voluntary choice of not actually including lids and choosing high-pressure toilet flushes for efficiency, energetic efficiency, but also efficiency in cases where patient turnout is high. And in those cases, those choices for not having a lid, for example, were taken to minimize biofilm formation, so contamination and attachment of other type of organisms on surfaces. And therefore, the question was, well, given that these are high-pressure flushes toilets, to which extent can we explain the recirculation of certain strains that seem to linger in the hospital that individuals sometimes come in without and leave with the emission of potential aerosols from these devices, these modern high-pressure toilet flushes. And indeed, it was quite surprising to see how much of the droplets were much smaller than what I expected initially. And therefore, these droplets would fall in the same group as the small droplets from the sneeze and coughs, in the sense that they can travel further, linger in the rooms, because they're not going to really settle on surfaces to be cleaned and in with the current surface sanitizing protocols.
Are our home flush toilets also putting out a spray like this?
So when I tested the more gravitational toilet flushes that are more common in households, there's a lot less coming out. And in fact, most households also have lids, so the advice would be to lower that lid and make sure that it's clean, obviously, regularly for minimizing biofilms. But the real concerns are in these public spaces and common spaces, where for energy efficiency, water efficiency, and turnaround efficiency, we really need to have that optimal high-pressure flush. But yet, right. By optimizing for that, we could be creating second effects, which are very small drops emitted.
So put the lid down.
At
home. Does your work make you a bit of a germaphobe? I have to say
that that's the case. However, I work hard to not go too far on that tendency and stay, you know, on the normal. But initially, after having worked on these two problems and other problems as well that relate to droplets, contaminants, circulation indoors, I did start to be a little bit too aware of all these issues.
How could you not be? Of course, the idea for you, though, is to come up with some mathematical descriptions of how these things all travel in the air.
That's right. So what we're trying to do is not just have empirical data. So first of all, really shedding light and putting videos and in some sense shedding light on these phenomena allow us to see them, which is great for public awareness, but also measure precisely. So we actually developed different image processing algorithms to try to extract the data in terms of droplet sizes, temporal evolution, so with time and space, where is all this going? But then also develop mathematical models, basically fluid dynamics models based on equations to understand better how could we more efficiently target these processes to change them, minimize them. So how do we, you have so many parameters that you could be changing to try to address this problem, but that would be years and years of really sort of empirical research. But if you understand the process, the physics that govern those emissions, you can narrow down that list and start having predictive models and interventions that are more
targeted. We have to narrow down our interview. That's Lydia Bariba, assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering, mechanical engineering at MIT. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. And she's also starring on our latest video, our Breakthrough Series, which is produced with Howard Hughes Medical Institute. It's also there up on our website at sciencefriday.com/splatter. Kudos to Emily Driscoll and Lou Graskin for work on that. That's all the time we have today. Charles Berquist is our director. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.